Hi guys, welcome back to Encyclopedia Alcoholica, the only podcast that believes a pint of lager is a living organism. Always good. All right, so today we're gonna talk about, which I promised, yeah, that we're gonna talk about Syd Barrett. So the name of the episode is The Madcap Laughs, LSD and Mental Illness of Syd Barrett, Pink Floyd's First Frontman. Which it is, yeah. First, I have an apology to make for the last episode, which I mentioned that Syd died of an heroin overdose, which is not. It was a wrong fact because, you know, I had like, you know, a book that I read about Syd Barrett, something like that. He had an overdose, but of other things, yeah. So let's get this straight, yeah. So I make a confusion of our next episode was going to be Bradley Nowell, the frontman of the American band Sublime, which is very nice, wicked band. So what I'm saying is this, you know, it's confused. I don't want anybody to get, you know, strung about this one, yeah. But the question that we have today is that we're going to talk about Syd Barrett, and you know, it's really strange, but we're gonna get there. So if we're gonna talk about Syd, I'm gonna tell you he is by far one of the most enigmatic and controversial figures in record, and it's very weird, you know. It's like he was like a guy that, you know, was fuck, man, I'm gonna read it, you have to go, yeah. And the thing is, the production of the two albums is always, you know, involved in a lot of stuff, strange things that happen, you know. But we're gonna get there, you know. There, yeah, we're gonna go. To be honest, I'm one of the people that didn't like the first two Pink Floyd albums. I didn't like it, you know. Of course, Atom Art Mother, which was the third one. It was really better, you know. It's like a little bit of comparison, yeah. It's like, you know, taste, yeah. It's like I didn't like the first two, you know. So that's the thing, and I thought it was experimental, whatever, yeah. So when I decided to make this show, I'm gonna be really honest here, without any complex, yeah. I didn't listen to the Syd Barrett albums because I was like, it's like one of those things that you keep on the closet. Yes, come on, man. I'll listen to it later. Fuck it. I'm going to listen to it later. It's never, you know, it's like one of those things that you keep on pushing, keep on putting it back, yeah? You never really want to do it. Or it's like in my bucket list, listen to the Syd Barrett albums. All right, fuck it. Leave it over there. And I was surprised. I really like the albums. It's two albums. Then you have like a third one, which is Opal, which is like a compilation of tracks that were not finished, and he finished in 1988 and stuff like that. So it's really, really good. I'm gonna leave it on the pod description, the links for Spotify for Syd Barrett, and man, you're gonna love it if you like Pink Floyd. The weird thing about these albums, if you want to think, then we're going to discuss it later. They were produced, you know, in retrospect, about, it's like two Pink Floyd albums. Because the guys that play there, which is Nick Mason, Roger Waters, then in certain aspects you have David Gilmour putting a little bit of effort on the albums, then the albums will, long story short, it's like, you know, only what was missing there, you know. It's a Pink Floyd album, you know, with Syd Barrett. It was like I'm gonna say the 3 and 4, because that thing was I think 1970, and Wish You Were Here were 1971. So they were pausing after the second album, and then, you know, they did this because of Syd's unusual personality, let's say, yeah. So let's start about this, yeah. So Roger Keith Barrett, which named Syd, which is a nickname, yeah, was born in 6th of January 1946, and he died with 60 years old in 7th of July 2006, was an English singer, songwriter, and musician who co-founded the rock band Pink Floyd. In 1965, Barrett was the original formation and primary songwriter, being known whimsical, psychedelic, English accent singing, literary influences, and esteem of consciousness. Writing style as a guitarist was influential about his free-form playing and foreign part dissonance, distortion, echo and feedback, and other studio effects. If you see the guitar of Syd Barrett, even that's weird. You know, it's like a guitar with, you know, with mirrors stuck in round mirrors, little round mirrors on the thing. It's a Fender Telecaster, which I really don't enjoy. Some colors I like. It's like you know, it's like a love-hate relationship. Sometimes I love that guitar, and sometimes I hate it. If people, you know, or the colors or something like that, because it's the antithesis of the surf guitar, which is another Fender, you know. So, but you got, if you know your music, you know what the thing is. Let's continue. Originated as a painter, Barrett was musically active for less than 10 years with Pink Floyd. He recorded four singles for their debut album, The Piper at the Gates of Dawn in 67, which I referred, was the first one, in portions of the second album, A Saucer Full of Secrets, because, you know, it's like, it's a very, these two albums are very experimental, very. And if you don't know Pink Floyd, it's a really, how can I explain, it's a little bit of a letdown, because they are very, very good. And these two were like, man, come on, it's like, fuck, man, it's like first in two albums. Normally, I always like the first albums of the bands. For example, Megadeth, I don't like the first two albums. I think they're crap. But the other one started to, the thing, Pink Floyd is the same thing, yeah? It's like they catch the train a little bit late, you know? So that's the thing here, yeah? And several unreleased songs, which goes in Opel, yeah, and this one. In April 68, Barrett was ousted from the band on speculation of mental illness and excessive use of psychedelic drugs, yeah? So this is like, I just put it here just for people to understand what the thing was there, yeah? Because that's what happened, you know? So he only stayed like with Pink Floyd for 2 years, 67 to 69. Then in 1970, he did like the two solo albums, which are great, yeah? But I'm gonna go in. In 1972, Barrett left the music industry completely, yeah? Retired from public life, and he strictly guarded his privacy until his death, yeah? Right, he continued painting it, he continued to his gardening. He was a very weird guy. You know, and Pink Floyd records several tributes to homage him, yeah? Including the 1970 song suite, Shine On You Crazy Diamond, which is one of the best Pink Floyd songs. If you don't know it, go listen. And the 1979 rock opera, The Wall, you know? So it's dedicated to him. You know, he was like, I think it was the main influence what Pink Floyd became, yeah? It's like the, you know, the first guy that touched it. You know, Roger Waters and David Gilmour, which was the two singers that follow suit, yeah? Second and third, because Roger Waters was the second and David Gilmour the third, which I don't know which one is better. I think I like the two of them, so I can't really say that the thing was there. But Syd Barrett, for them, was always the lead singer, because he was that good. And if you listen to the solo albums, man, you get it. You get it. You're gonna. That's why they like it so much, you know, and try to really push him around and stuff like that. But he was like a nutcase, so, you know, that's when. So I'm going to continue here. So Barrett played the piano occasionally, but usually preferred writing and drawing. He bought an ukulele age 10, a banjo at 11, and an Ofner acoustic guitar at 14. A year after he purchased the first acoustic guitar, he brought his first electric guitar and built his own amplifier. Genius, yeah? One story of how Barrett acquired the name Syd is that at the age of 14, he was named after the old local Cambridge jazz club double bassist Syd the Beat Barrett, which claims Syd Barrett changed the spelling to differentiate himself from his namesake, yeah? All right. At this point, at Morley Memorial Junior School, which he was like the you know, it's like, you know, like a secondary school or whatever, yeah? He was taught by mother of future Pink Floyd bassist Roger Waters. Later, in 1957, he attended Cambridge High School for Boys with Waters, Roger Waters, yeah? His father died of cancer on 11 of December 1961, less than a month before Barrett's 16th birthday. On this date, Barrett left the entry in his diary blank. By this time, his brothers and sisters had left home, and his mother decided to rent out the room for lodgers, yeah? So he's like the fourth of five children, yeah? It was tough, yeah? Eager to help his son recover from his grief, Barrett's mother encouraged the band in which he played, was a very strange name, Geoff Mott and the Mottos. Weird, yeah? A band which Barrett formed to perform in their front room. Waters and Barrett were childhood friends, and Waters often visit such gigs. At one point, Waters organized a gig at a CND benefit at Friends Meeting House, yeah, on the 11th of March 1962. But shortly afterward, Geoff Mott joined Boston Crabs and the Mottos broke up. So this is like junior bands and teenage bands and whatever, fuck, you know. So in September 1962, Barrett had taken a place at the art department of the Cambridge College of Arts and Technology, where he met David Gilmour, the third vocalist of Pink Floyd, yeah? In late 1962 and 63, the Beatles made an impact on Barrett, and he began to play Beatles songs and parties at picnics. In 63, Barrett became a Rolling Stones fan, yeah? And then girlfriend Libby Gosden saw them perform in a village hall in Cambridgeshire, you know? At this point, Barrett started writing songs. One friend recalls hearing Effervescing Elephant, so I think I'm not gonna go out on a limb here. It's from is a song from the second album. I didn't like it so much, but all right. Okay, hey. No, exactly. That's what it says here. It later to be recorded in his solo album, at Barrett, which is the second. The first one is The Madcap Laughs. Yeah? All right. Also around this time, Barrett and Gilmour occasionally played acoustic gigs together. Barrett had played bass guitar with those without... In mid 63, and bass and guitar with the Hollering Blues the next summer. In 1964, Barrett and Gosden, which is, you know, another guy, yeah, saw Bob Dylan perform. At this performance, Barrett was inspired to write Bob Dylan Blues. Barrett, now thinking about his future, decided to apply to the Camberwell College of Arts in London. He enrolled in the college in summer 1964 to study painting. You know, at this time, people that know Pink Floyd is when they head out to London and start really, you know, applying their trade, yeah? So it was Roger Waters was already there, and I think at the time, you know, like then come another guy that was Rob something, which guy, sorry, I can't remember the name now, was something like German, yeah? So he was one of the guitarists of Pink Floyd. Now he's a photographer or something like that. And they you know, started there their in psychedelia or something like that, what you can call it, you know. It was the first beginnings of the band, you know. They played in those bars in Oxford Circus, Piccadilly, whatever, yeah, in Shoreditch. They did all the circuit in London, yeah. Which was nice, you know. It was the days that, you know, before Pink Floyd became Pink Floyd, yeah. They were experimental, but it was like, man, it was really, really experimental. If you saw, I think there's a documentary on YouTube, if you know it, Sid Barrett, you know, in first person or something like that. I can't remember now the name, but you see there, you know, you see the, you know, is you know, the those years, yeah. Those years are not very talked about. It was before the Piper at the Gates of Dawn. Which, man, fucking hell, man, it's weird. You know, people. Some people like it, some people don't. I'm in the camp that don't. So, hey, that's it. And starting in 1964, the band would become Pink Floyd, evolved through various lineups and name changes, including the Abdads, the Scream Abdads, Sigma Six, and the Megadeths. I was talking about Megadeths earlier. Jesus. In 1965, Barrett joined them as the T-Set, sometimes spelled T-Set, where they found themselves playing at a concert with another band of the same name, Barrett came up with the Pink Floyd sound, also known as the Pink Floyd Blues Band, yeah, and later the Pink Floyd, and then only Pink Floyd, yeah. All right, during 1965, they went into a studio with the first time with a friend of Richard Wright. And the band gave the band free time to record, yeah. All right, during this time, this is where it starts, the shit goes downhill, yeah. So this is where it starts. During this summer, Barrett had his first LSD trip in the garden of friend Dave Gale and Ian Moore and Storm Torgerson, some guys. You know, during one trip, Barrett and another friend, Paul Cherry, ended up naked in the bath, reciting, "No rules, no rules." That summer, as a result of continued drug use, the band became absorbed in St. Matt's sect. Yeah, it's like a... like a Sikh something, you know, like those Anwars that you have here in the UK. All right. So, they went to a London hotel to meet the sex guru. You know, Torgerson managed to join the sect. Barrett, however, was deemed too young to join. Torgerson see this as a deeply important event in Barrett's life, as he was extremely upset by the rejection. While living near his friends, Barrett decided to write more songs. Bike, which is like, I think, man, I can't really position the album. I'm not going to say it, but I think it's one of the first ones. Yeah, all right. While Pink Floyd began to play in cover versions of American R&B songs, by 1966 they have carved out their own style of improvised rock and roll, which drew as much from improvised jazz. After Bob Close, which is the guy that I can remember, said it was something like German or whatever, yeah, departed from the band direction changed. However, the change was not instantaneous, with more improvising on the guitars and keyboards. Drummer Nick Mason reflected, "It always felt to me that the most of the ideas were emanating from Sid at the time, you know?" Fucking hell, LSD, whoa. I try it once. Don't do it at home, kids, serious. Stay out of drugs. All at this time, Barrett, reading reputedly included Grimm's Fairy Tales, Tolkien's The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings, and The I Ching, which is one of, I think, a lot of books that he dedicated his songs. If you go to the, I think, the second album, you find a lot of these, a lot of, and little tips. You know, I read the album very carefully. That's why I said when I proposed to do this, I had to go really deep, because I knew, you know, the first two albums, but I never listened to the solos. Man, it's great. Go check it out. I'm just going to say it, yeah? During this period, Barry wrote most of songs for Pink Floyd's first album, The Piper at the Gates of Dawn, yeah? And also songs that would later appear in his solo albums in 1966. A new rock concert venue, the UFO, pronounced UFO, which is a club, yeah, opened in London and quickly became a haven for British psychedelic music. If you see that documentary I said on YouTube, they have like footage, a lot. Pink Floyd, the house band, was the most popular attraction, and after making an appearance at Rivet Roundhouse, became the most popular music group in the London underground psychedelic music scene. By the end of 1966, Pink Floyd had gained a reliable management team, Andrew King and Peter Jenner. Peter Jenner, it comes a little bit later in the story, which is like manager and kind of producer or something like that, which the story of the first album, which was completely out of his mind, you know. Then he was one of the producers, then he gives to some guy named Malcolm, whatever. Then I'm gonna get there, yeah. For the end of the October 1966, Pink Floyd and King Jenner set up Black Hill Enterprises, which managed the group's finances, yeah. So this Black Hill Enterprises is like the, you know, like a thing with finance, with accountants, which get like all the royalties and whatever, yeah. So this Black Hill Enterprises, I think it's still the, you know, where you know, if you want to play a Pink Floyd song, that's why you pay it. You know, it's kind of still the management of the Pink Floyd intellectual property or whatever. Man, I don't understand nothing about laws. It's a little bit like that, yeah? So, Black Hill was staffed by Roger Jenner, yeah? Found his Ed Brook Roundhouse, among others. Barrett's flatmate, Peter Wine Wilson, who became a road manager, yeah. However, since he had more experience in lighting, he was sort of lighting assistant, you know, just like, you know, get whatever, yeah. King and Jenner was always wanted to prepare some demo recordings for the possible record deal, yeah. So at the end of October, they booked a session at Thompson Private Recording, yeah, studio in Emel Hempstead. King said of the demos, "This was the first time I realized they were going to write all their own material. Sid just turned into a songwriter. It seemed like overnight, King and Jenner befriended American expatriate Joe Boyd, the promoter of the UFO Club, who is making a name for himself as one of the most important entrepreneurs on the British music scene. Newer hired a booking agent, Brian Morrison." This is like stuff and stuff like that, but you have to read it anyways. "Proposed sending in better quality recordings for Morrison agency. The band played a gig outside of London for the first time in November. The band performed the many of strangely named concerts, Philadelphic Music for Simian Hominids." Fucking hell, who remembers this shit? "You know, a multimedia event arranged by the group's former landlord, Mike Leonard, at Hornsey College of Art. They perform at the free school for the performing 2 weeks. Yeah, before going at Psychedelia versus Ian Smith." Man, Jesus Christ, this is hard to read. "Even at the Roadhouse in December, arranged by the Majority Rule for Rhodesia campaign and Oxfam benefit at Albert Hall, the band's biggest venue at this point." So, man, this is like very weird because it's like, man, you're reading like, woo, woo, woo. It's weird, serious. So let's continue, yeah. "At the beginning of 1967, Barrett was dating Jenny Spires." Let's go, I just got lost here. "It was a girl or something like that that married another guy, you know, like in their midst. I don't know. It's very weird. "However, unknown to Barrett, Spires had an affair with Pete Whitehead. As Spires convinced Whitehead, who thought the band sounded like a bad Schoenberg, which is like shit, yeah, to Pink Floyd in a film with the singing lugging scenes." That's the footage that I talked to you about in that documentary. I saw it. It's nice. "So the cost of £80, the equivalent of £1,485 in 2020, yeah? In January, Whitehead took the band into John Wood's Sound Techniques in Chelsea. With promoter John Byrne in tow, here the band recorded a 16-minute version of Interstellar Overdrive. And another comfort is Nick's Boogie." I think, if I'm not mistaken, I think this isn't the first album. But I think it's one deluxe edition that you have to find, but go check. It's there, no worries. I think that's the thing. It's like a very strange thing with guitars and distortion, and then you have like the drum blah, 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 playing. It's a little bit weird, yeah. Whitehead had filmed this recording, which was used in the film Let's All Make Love in London, the night Let's All Make Love in London, and later on the video release at London 66 and 67. This is like a thing that was used in the. There's a little bit of box sets, yeah, and then you started, you know, to get the first images of Pink Floyd. That is, I think it's called the Early Years. It's very nice. I heard it, you know. But that's the thing, you know. It's like weird stuff. And this time, you know, Pink Floyd doesn't sound like, man. Come on, On the Wall, Dark Side of the Moon, Wish You Were Here, Atom Heart Mother. So, or a lot of the sounds we really know about Pink Floyd, you know, this was not. This is completely heading a different direction, and you know, and then that the thing when I listen to this, you know, you really have to get high or drunk, or one of them, you know, you have to pick in once, yeah. Whitehead later commented that the band, they were just completely welded together, just like a jazz group. And it was very, you know, like, it looks like it doesn't have sense, the music, but it had. That thing has all arrangements and stuff like that, but it was really confusing. You know, you have to get high or drunk, you know, pick one. All right. Boyd attended to side the band with Polydor Records. However, Morrison had convinced King and Jenner to try to start a bidding war between Polydor and EMI. In late January, Boyd produced a recording session for the group, with them returning to the Sound Techniques in Chelsea again. After the bidding war idea was finished, Pink Floyd signed to EMI. Yeah, unusual for the time, the deal included the recording of an album, which meant the band had unlimited time at EMI studios. So this was like this: you have time to go around shit, and I think they didn't. You know, I think they it was a little bit half-assed. The first two albums were really half-assed, but that's what you have to go. Yeah. In return for a small royalty percentage, yeah, for that's the time, the band attempted to record Anne Lane, which was one of the, I think it's one of the singles from the first album, yeah. And but the Boyd version from January was released instead in the first band studio album, the Piper at the Gates of Dawn. It was recorded intermittently, that's what I'm saying, you know, they... Or they have too much time on their hands, or they were fucking drunk or high or something like that. Because it was like it was a little bit like the Barrett albums. It was like, you know, do one song here, do one song there. It was not a work that you do every day. You pick up, let's do something today. Let's do something tomorrow. That's basically the same. Yeah. Let's go. Yeah, it was recorded between February and July 1967 at Studio 3 at Abbey Road Studios. Real famous place, yeah. And produced by former Beatles engineer Norman Smith. He's a very famous guy. If you know your music, you know who he is. By the time the album was released in 4 August, Arden Lane, which was released months earlier, 11 March, has reached number 20 in the British singles chart. You can see Arden Lane. It's like a... You know, little tune, yeah. And you saw the guys very young, you know, like Sid, David, Roger Waters, Nick Mason, very young, you know, like kids, you know. It's really weird when you see them now, you know. You like, it's a band of old farts, you know. But at the time, it was like fucking hell, man. Really, really awesome, yeah. So and then you have like the what I think was the most famous song from of Syd Barrett. It's one of my favorite Pink Floyd songs. You See Emily Play. It's a very nice conjecture. Yeah, I love it. The See Emily Play is very nice. And then I can understand them. They see that he is a genius, because the way he sings in that particular song is completely awesome. That's why I say it's like a love-hate relationship with you, with the audiences, yeah? Because they go from very good to completely, man. It's crazy, those things. So it was hitting, that See Emily Play was hitting in number 6 in the British album charts. The first three singles, including their third, Apples and Oranges, were written by Barrett, who was also the principal visionary and author that created 1967 of the 11 songs of Piper. Barrett wrote 8 and co-wrote the other two. So these two are the real thing. Piper at the Gates of Dawn was all him, you know. But weird, but was all him, you know. Try to think this thing through, yeah. So I'm gonna go through his elf problems, yeah. So I'm gonna tell you why I think I tell the overdose the other day, because I had a book. But it was a Portuguese edition, yeah. You know, and sometimes you get a little bit, sidetracked, yeah, because it's too much information in your mind. And you have sometimes, if I don't have the book, I couldn't relate myself. That's why I said that thing the other day, yeah. So, follow me through here, yeah. Through late 1967 and early 68, Barrett became increasingly erratic, partly as a consequence of reporting heavy use of psychedelic drugs, such as LSD. That here is the thing, you know, the overdose was LSD, because you can hack this shit, it's too strong, yeah. And the one they did in the 60s was really the OG, the original, yeah. So, you know, sometimes people take LSDs nowadays, you know, it's not that strong, but at that time it was like the OG, the good one, yeah. I think it's acetylic acid, something like that. I can remember the compound now. That's it. There was also speculation that he suffered from schizophrenia. Once described as a joyful, friendly, and extroverted, he became increasingly depressed and withdrawn, and experienced hallucinations, disorganized speech, memory lapses, intense mood swings, and periods of catatonia. Although the changes began gradually, he went missing for a long weekend, and according to several friends, including Wright, which is one of the members of Pink Floyd, come back as a completely different person. Man, that's the thing was like this, man. The guy had problems, yeah? So you put like LSD, you know, it goes, that thing goes out. It's completely fucking nuts. And if you take this shit, you know, for a lot of days, this is not like coke, this is not like weed, this is not like any other drug that you take, because it in some ways, what I read about sometimes LSD, which I don't like, I tried it once and forget it, don't want it again. It changes a little bit of the chemistry of your brain, because that thing gives you strong hallucinations and stuff like that. So it rearranged some wiring inside, let's say, yeah? So that thing, if you take too much, you know, that's what happens when you take ecstasy a lot, you know, you fry up. That's what happened here, you know? But this, I'm saying, this is the 60s. When they discovered that thing, was really, really hard. It was really, really strong. One of the striking features of his change was the development of a blank, dead-eyed stare. Barrett did not recognize his friends and often did not know where he was. On a tour of Los Angeles, Barrett was said to have explained, "Gee, it's sure nice to be in Las Vegas." Many reports described him as on stage, stunning one, court in the entire concert, or not playing at all, you know, just like didn't give a fuck. Yeah, at a show in Santa Monica, Barrett is slowly to tune his guitar. An interview on Pat Boone, a show during the tour, Barrett replied with a blank and totally mood stare. According to Mason, Sid wasn't moving his lips that day. Barrett exhibited a similar behavior during the band's first appearance on Dick Clark television American show American Bandstand. I would like to have this footage, like the guy, you know, like, you know, it's the big thing for them, and the guy stands catatonic, and man, come on, I'm not laughing, but it's just like, man, it should be like one thing, it's unmissable, let's say, yeah, if a guy gets like in American television, like, it should be crazy. Surviving footage of this appearance, which I never saw, and I want to get it, you know, shows Barrett miming his parts competently, yeah? However, during a group interview afterwards, Barrett gave tense as answers. During this time, Barrett would forgot to bring his guitar to sessions, damage equipment, and was occasionally unable to hold his plectrum. Before a performance in late 67, Barrett reported crushed Mandrax tranquilizer tablets and a tube of Brile cream into his hair, which melted down his face under the heat of stage light, making him look like a guttered candle. Mason disputed the Mandrax portion of this story, stating that Sid would never waste good mandies. Yeah. All right. So we're going to go to the part that is the departure from Pink Floyd, you know, his start of his solo career. Yeah. So, during the Pink Floyd's UK tour with Jimi Hendrix in November 67, guitarist David O'List from The Knee substituted for Barrett for several occasions when he was unable to perform or failed to appear. Around Christmas, Pink Floyd asked Barrett's school friend David Gilmour to join. David Gilmour, yeah, see? And the second guitarist to cover Barrett for a handful of shows. Gilmour played and the song and sang while Barrett wandered around in stage, occasionally joining the performance. So this man, if I had like footage of this, it was like completely nice. You go like the scene, man, I don't want to be here. Fucking hell, man, this is crazy. The other band members grew tired of Barrett's antics. And on 26th of January 68, when Waters was driving on the way to a show at Southampton University, they elected not to pick Barrett up. One person in the car said, "Shall we pick Sid up?" And another said, "Let's not bother." Because it's true, man. Fucking hell. The guy was like an embarrassment for himself and the band. You can't hack this one, yeah? Barrett had written the bulk of the band's material, the plan was to retain him as a non-tourist member, as the Beach Boys has done with Brian Wilson, which I think was one of the, I think it was the drummer, I think. It was a guy, a very strange guy. I think he died or something like that. But I'm not going to say it. Sorry, but this is a lot of things I read, yeah. But this proved impractical. According to Waters, Barrett came to what was to be their last practice session with a new song he dubbed Have You Got It Yet? The song seemed simple when you first presented it, but as soon as it became impossible, difficult to learn, the band eventually realized that Barrett was changing the agreement as they played, and that Barrett was playing a joke on them, yeah? What is called a real act of a mad genius. God didn't give a fuck. No, serious. One of the songs Barrett wrote for people after the Piper at the Gates of Dawn, only Jug Band Blues, which is in the second album, let me get this right, A Saucerful of Secrets, yeah? In 1968, Apples and Oranges became an unsuccessful single, the third from the Piper of the Gate, and Scream, Thy Last Scream, and Vegetable Man. That's what I'm saying. You go to these kind of boxes, you find these crazy songs, yeah? And remain unreleased until 2016, the early years, 65 to 72. That's a box set, yeah? You can find it on Spotify, you know. It's very weird. As they were deemed too dark and unsettling, Barrett played guitar on the Saucerful of Secrets tracks, Remember a Day, and Set the Controls for the Heart of the Sun. Feeling guilty, the members of Pink Floyd were unable to bring themselves, definitely, to tell Barrett that he was no longer in the band. According to Wright, who lived with Barrett at the time, he told Barrett that he was going to buy cigarettes when leaving to play a show. Guy was completely out. He would return hours later to find Barrett in the same position, sometimes with a cigarette burned completely down to his fingers. An incident referenced in Pink Floyd's concert film The Hall. Emerging from catatonia and unaware that a long period of time has elapsed, Barrett would ask, "Have you got the cigarettes?" Man, come on, this guy was like, that's what I'm saying, man. It was an overdose of LSD. The guy, you know, like, you know, I think it was like eating chocolates, a box of chocolates, LSD, man, come on, you get high every day. That thing is 6 hours to get out of your organism. Imagine what you have to do. Barrett Lee supposedly spent outside the recording studio in the reception area and waiting to be invited in. He also came to a few performances while he glared at Gilmer, his replacement, yeah? On 6th of April, 68, Pink Floyd official that Barrett was no longer in the band member, yeah? In the same day, the contract with Black Hill Enterprises were terminated, yeah? Considering him as the band's musical leader, Black Hill Enterprises retained Barrett. So they retained Barrett because they wanted to do the solo albums, or because of the intellectual property, you know. It's law stuff and management, and I can't really tell you what it is. So, after leaving Pink Floyd, Barrett was out of the public eye for a year. In 1969, at the behest of EMI and Albert, he embarked on a briefly solo career, releasing two albums, The Mad Cat Laughs and Barrett, both in 1970. So, that's now we're gonna revised or review, yeah, the production of these two albums, because it's real funny. You know, this the guy had like things that he walked out of studios about. I'm gonna continue here. After Barrett left Pink Floyd in April 68, Peter Jenner and Andrew King from the band's management followed suit. In May, Jenner led Barrett into EMI Studio on Abbey Road in Northwest London to record some solo material, the only part which would later appear at the Madcap Labs. Jenner thought Barrett would like to finish the tracks that Jenner transferred from that previous October. Barrett, on the other hand, had other plans. During this tentative session, Jenner was failed to properly record any vocals at all the tracks. Golden Hair, it was a beautiful track. Late Night Clowns and Jugglers, lately retitled Octopus, was like, I think is the best song he has. It's really good. You listen to this, you're gonna like. Silas Lang and Lanky, parts 1 and 2. After recording had resumed in June and July, progress continued on these tracks, especially Swan Lee. And a new improved version of Clown and Jugglers was taped at this point also. Barrett would commit to recording the track Ramadan Sick to the tape or whatever, yeah. Although Jenner claims that he got well with the singer, he also states that the 1968 session had not gone smoothly, admitting, "I had seriously underestimated the difficulties of working with him." Shortly after the July dates, Barrett abruptly stopped recording, breaking up with girlfriend Lindsay Korn, which is not important, but all right, and then going off in a drive around Britain in his Mini. He ended up in a psychiatric care in Cambridge. I don't imagine what he went down, and I want to be a camera inside that Mini, because it should be like fucking nuts for a guy that does this, all these kind of things, man. His mind was not really there, you know. It's fucking crazy. By the start of 69, somewhat recovered Barrett decided to return to his musical career and revisit the Jenner produced recordings, which is these ones, yeah. He contacted EMI and passed on to Malcolm Jones, then head of EMI's new prog rock label Harvest. After both Jenner and Norman Smith, which is the producer from the Beatles that you heard about sooner, yeah, Pink Floyd's producer at the time, declined to work on the album. Jones agreed to take on this role. Yeah? So we come to this Malcolm Jones session. I said, like, it was the Jenner sessions, the Malcolm Jones sessions. It was like, fuck, this is nuts, man. Nobody in this time or age imagined to work with a guy like this. Because the guy is a genius, or he's fucking nuts. And, you know, or you get rid as him. You know, I think this goes to history, you know. I think it was the four albums that he worked, because I think he only has four. He has two with Pink Floyd, two with the thing. Then he has like some collaborations with other guys who's not important. Yeah, but I think this goes to the mythology of music. Yeah, the way this thing went, fucking hell, man. Let's go on this. Yeah. So Malcolm Jones had little difficulty in persuading his boss, Roy Featherstone, and Ron White, authorizer of EMI Recordings, to allow Barrett to record with the company again. With the company, yeah, sorry. In April 69, the young executive took over the project and Barrett began working on newer material. While reworking the 1968 recordings, Jones would later explain the rationale behind EMI letting Barrett record again. What they say is, what was decided was to see what the strength of Sid's new material and plan accordingly. It worked then, okay, we do an album, it's not, we call it a day. So it's like, man, it's like, I think it's like the same thing with his bandmates. They want to see if he's still, let's say, if he's still there, you know, if he's still, you know, the same guy, which I really don't think he was. You know, I think at this time it declined so much, you know, and you know, if you check the albums, it's fucking great. I think it was, I think I had like a book, I don't know, I think I had it, I have in my house in Portugal, not here. I think it was like the 1,000 albums that if you have to hear before you die. Yeah, it's like those big books that you have 1,000 films before you die or something like that. And I remember to see these two albums. I think one was like 700 and something like that, and the other one is 800 and something like that. All right, I can't really tell you where they was, yeah? But they always said like, man, it's very good and blah, blah, blah. But that's what I'm saying. It's a bucket list question. Yeah, it's like you think about it. I'm not going to go, I'm going to listen to this later, because you only have left something good to hear before of that, you know. It's like what it is, yeah. So let's go again here. In April 69, the young executive, this guy Malcolm something, yeah, took over the project, and Barrett began working on the new material. While reworking the 68 recording, Jones would later explain that the rationale behind AMI, what? Oh man, Jesus, sorry about that, guys. You know, this thing went up again. You know, it's like sometimes, you know, the you know, the how can I explain, the iPhone goes up and down, you know, and I turn it and then I lost this one, yeah. So the Bad Cap Laughs, yeah. So it's the first album, and it comes like in the third, you know, like a third reopening, let's say, yeah. So with David Gilmour, that's why I say this is like two Pink Floyd albums, because they were all involved. I think the only guy, and I don't know if he gets like an uncredited role in the second album, was Richard Wright, of those all the Pink Floyd guys, you know. So they all worked in this album. So I think this is like, it's not credited as a Pink Floyd album, but you can always listen to it, and you're gonna go like, man, this is Pink Floyd, yeah. The early Pink Floyd, I think the album that I can, you know, retrace for those two albums a little bit, if I can, you know, do a comparison, is Atom Heart Mother. Yeah, completely. I always have trouble saying this shit. Umga Mumma or something like that was like the third album, which is, it's good, it's reasonable, yeah. So Jones states that when David came to me and said that Sid wanted him and Roger to remain parts of the album, yeah, I acquiesced. Roger Waters and David Gilmour were in the process of completing this, let's see if I can say it, Pink Floyd, Uma Guma, you know, album. When they got involved in the Madcap Labs that July and helped Barrett finish this album, in a two-day sprint, according to Pink Floyd biographer Rick Sanders, we had a very little time. Gilmour recalled in a May of 2003 interview, Sid was very difficult. We got that very frustrating feeling. Look, it's your fucking career, mate. Why don't you get your finger out and do something? This guy was in trouble and was close friend to me for many years before then. So it is really the least one can do, you know. So they got together. So the man, they got like some intellectual property or something like that to get him to the rest of his days, you know, and then some royalties that came into his account, you know, because the guy was completely fucked in the head, yeah. So let's go back to this. After the first session with new producer Gilmour and Waters on 12th of June, they had like remade Clowns and Jugglers into Octopus from the Soft Machines overdub version, and they recorded Golden Hair, very good song as well, Long Gone and Dark Love, attention to this one, very good. At the following day, the session was dedicated to overdubbing Octopus. This became Barrett's final session for over a month. Due to a temporary halt, while Gilmour and Waters Uma Guma, they mixed it, yeah, to Barrett's dismay, and Floyd tour in the Netherlands. However, towards the end of July in 26, they managed to record She Took a Long Cold Look at Me, Feel Is in You, another version of Long Gone, an attempted remake of Dark Globe, and even a medley at She Took, Feel and If It Is You. So I think this is in Opal, but you can check, man. Okay, I'm not gonna make the same mistake I did in the first one, yeah. Barrett would not allow the musicians to rehearse or to record their overdubs, insisting they sounded fine. After several months of intermittent recording, the album was finally deemed complete. After their final recording session of the album had been complete, Gilmour and Waters mixed not just the tracks they had produced, but also the Jones tracks, you know, that guy that came early. In a matter of 2 days, five tracks were mixed and fixed. Long Gone, She Took, Feel, if It's in You, and Octopus. The following day, Three Cross, Golden Hair, Dark Globe, Terrapin, this one is very nice, were mixed in just 3 hours. The track order was a sequence by Barrett and Gilmour on the 6th of October. Let's go again. Upon release, Gilmour said, perhaps we were trying to show what Sid was really like. That's what they did, yeah. But perhaps we are trying to punish him, yeah. Barry stated that it's quite nice, but I'd be very surprised if I did anything if I was dropped to drop dead. I don't think I would stand, as my latest statement. Positive, yeah. Waters made a moral to basically declared Barrett a genius. Malcolm Jones was shocked at what is perceived as the substantial musicmanship of the Gilmour and Waters produced songs. However, I felt angry. It was a dirty linen in like cleaning dirty linen in public, and was very unnecessary and unkind. Barrett later said of the album, "I like what come out. It was released far too long after it was done. I wanted to it to be a whole thing. You know, it's like, you know, you record in a day, blah, 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 and you're gone. That's fucking crazy. You don't do things like this. I wanted that people would listen to all the way through and everything related to the balance, the tempos, the moods of settling each other. And I hope that's what it sounds like. And it wasn't. It's a very good album. In a bid to increase sales, Joan wrote a letter to music magazine Melody Maker under an alternate name, writing how great the album was. Yeah, on 6th of June 1970, gave his own one and only solo performance held at the Kensington Olympia, backed by Gilmour and Shirley. He baffled the audience and Gilmour and Shirley when he abruptly took out his guitar after the fourth number. And walk off stage. They play like Terrapin, Gigolo Ant, Effervescing Elephant and Octopus from the start at the performance up to, not including Octopus. The vocals were near audible. The performance has been bootlegged. Yeah, there's something in the net, but I'm going to look up about this. But come on, I have better shit to do. For our information, you guys, you know, we are doing like, you know, an odyssey on the other podcast, which I have to write. And this one is like the little brother, yeah. So I'm gonna try to keep on going with the Encyclopedia Alcoholica, but it's gonna be hard because, man, it's gonna be a 20 episode. I'm gonna announce it, you know, later on. But the thing was is about the red lines of the Second World War, which is like, you know, a complicated subject. Nobody tried to do that thing in podcast. We are the only guys that have balls to do it because it's very, very problematic. But I explain, you know, in the other podcast, if you like it, man, check this out and check the other podcast that we have. History Forgives, But We Don't, which is like the primary, this is the secondary one, yeah? For their second album, Barrett was recorded more sporadic than the first one, yeah? With section taking place between February and July 1970. The album was produced by David Gilmour, yeah? And Philip Gilmour on bass guitar, Richard Wright, which is the other one of the members of King Floyd, and on keyboard, an humble pie drummer, Jerry Shirley, was the guy that did the same thing. 2 days later, he began working on his second album in Abbey Road Studios with Gilmour as producer and a trio of musicians, Richard Wright, Shirley, and Gilmour itself. The main aim for the Barrett sessions was to give Barrett the structure and focus many felt was missing during the long and unwieldy sessions for the Madcap Blast. Thus, the sections would more effectively run and the album would then finish in considerably less time than the Madcap Blast, 6 months compared to the Madcap's 1 year. On 6th of June 1970, Barrett gives his one and only, again, you know, it goes, the second one, yeah? In the Olympic in Kensington, backed once more by Gilmour and Shirley. At the end of Octopus, the fourth number of the set, Barrett baffled the others and his backing music with the brother taking off his guitar and walking off stage. Fucking hell, man, this guy is like top man, serious. Shirley said of Barrett's playing, he would never play the same tune twice. Sometimes Sid couldn't play anything that made sense. Other times, what he's played was absolute schmarrn. Barrett's direction to other musicians were the limited pronounces, like perhaps we could make a middle darker and maybe to the end middle afternoonish at the moment it is too windy or icy. So the guy was like, you know, completely fucked up in the head, yeah. So we're gonna go here when he resurfaced, yeah, because this was like 1971. And you know when we go, you know, a little bit further, you get like, for example, you get Dark Side of the Moon, you get Out of the Mark Mother, you get like all those Pink Floyd albums until 75, yeah. And then, which was the year I was born, yeah. It's always good. So this story goes to the when they did the Wish You Were Here album, which they, if you know Pink Floyd, is the one that you have like the guy burning, you know, shaking hands with the other one. I think it was Wish You Were Here. So he visited them, but I'm going to tell the story. Barrett visited the members of Pink Floyd in 1975 during the recordings for their ninth album, Wish You Were Here. He attended the Abbey Road session unannounced. He watched the band working on the final mix of Shine On You Crazy About Him, a song about him. By that time, Barrett, then 29, had become overweight and had shaved all of his hair, including his eyebrows. Nice. And his former band that did not initially recognize him, Barrett spent part of the session brushing his teeth. Walters asked him what he thought about the song, and he just said, like, it sounds a little bit old. Nice. He is reported to have briefly attended the reception for Gilmer's wedding to Ginger that immediately followed the recording session, but Gilmer said he had no recollection of this. A few years later, you know, I'm gonna go this, you know, it's like crazy. A few years later, Warriors saw Barrett in the department store of Harrods, which you don't know if you're not from this century, is a big you know, capitalist building on London, yeah? He has everything, even helicopters. So, Barrett ran outside, dropping his bags. It was the last time any member of Pink Floyd saw him. So, he fucked off. Game over. He wasn't seen anymore. For all his life, you know, he stayed like, that's it, nobody more. So, then he withdrew to Cambridge, yeah? So it was his hometown and stuff like that. In 78, when Barrett money ran out, he moved back to Cambridge to live with his mother. He returned to live in London for a few weeks in 1982, but soon returned to Cambridge permanently. Check this one out. Check the mind of this guy. Barrett walked up the 50 miles, 80 kilometers, in retrospect, yeah, from London to Cambridge. Until his death, he received royalties for his work in Pink Floyd. Gilmour said, I made sure the money got to him, so nobody see the guy anymore. Fucking crazy. In 1996, Barrett was inducted to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame as the member of Pink Floyd, but he didn't attend the ceremony, yeah? According to the biographer and journalist Tim Willis, Barrett, who had resorted to using his real name Roger, continued to live in his late mother's semi-detached house, and had returned to painting, creating less abstract canvases. It was nice. I saw the other day because when I was you know, doing research for the show, I went to see the whole thing to understand the mind of the guy a little bit. Yeah. So he also has been said to be an avid gardener, which he maintained, you know, like, you know, fucking hell, plants and shit like that. Come on, I don't have patience for this. His main point of contact with the outside world was his sister Rosemary, who lived nearby. He was reclusive and his physical health declined, and he suffered from stomach ulcers and type 2 diabetes. Although Barrett had not appeared or spoken in public since the mid-1970s, reporters and fans traveled to Cambridge to seek him. You know, there's photos in Google. I think I showed that sometimes guys taking a photo with opening the door, they saw it in the street, and the thing, I think one time I read something about it, that the guy was walking around the Cambridge with a tube of dental paste, yeah, and a toothbrush. The guy was completely out of it, you know. So, despite public appeals from his family, apparently Barrett did not like to be reminded about their musical careers, and the other members of Pink Floyd had no direct contact with him. However, he did visit his sister's house in November 2001 to watch the BBC Omnibus, a documentary made about him. I saw a little bit of this one. It's nice. Reportedly, he found some of a bit noisy, enjoyed seeing Mike Leonard again, calling him his teacher, and enjoyed hearing CMLE play. Beautiful. Barrett made a final public acknowledgement of his musical past in 2002, his first since the 1970s, when he autographed 320 copies of photographer Mick Rock's book Psychedelic Renegades, which contained a number of photos of Barrett. Rock was perhaps the last person in the music industry with whom Barrett kept contact with. In 1971, Rock conducted Barrett's final interview because he retired from the music industry. Barrett visited Rock in London several times for tea and conversation. In 1978, they had not spoken for more than 20 years when Rock approached Barrett to autograph his photographic book. And Barrett uncharacteristically agreed, having reverted to his birth name, Roger. Yeah, he autographed the book Barrett, death in after. Now we're gonna go to the death in aftermath of Syd Barrett. Basically, bad, but that's what it is. Barrett died at home in Cambridge on 7th of July 2006, age 60, from pancreatic cancer. He was cremated in 2006 in his home in St. Mary's Square, Cambridge, which is the story, yeah? Was put on the market and reportedly attracted considerable interest for more than for fans and stuff like that, yeah? After 100 showings, many of the fans, it was sold to a French couple who reportedly knew nothing about Barrett. Nice. On 28 November 2006, Barrett's older possession was sold at an auction at Shifton's Auction in Cambridge, raising £120,000 for charity. Items sold included paintings, scrapbooks, and everyday items that Barrett had decorated. NME produced a tribute issue to Barrett a week later with a photo of him on the cover. In an interview with the Sunday Times, Barrett's sister said that he had written and published a book about the history of art. In response to the news of Barrett, David Gilmour said, "We are very sorry that Roger Keefe, Barrett, right, Syd, yeah, has passed away. Do find the time to play some of Syd's songs to remember him as the madcap genius who made us all smile with his wonderful eccentric songs about bikes, gnomes and scarecrows. His career was painfully short, yet he touched more people than he could ever known." And that's the story, you know. It was like the guy who was really a genius. And the sad thing is, you know, his mind, you know, in those days with Floyd in the 70s, that he took like all those LSD pills and stuff like that and stamps. You know, you put the stamp and you go, phew. You I think is what we say in Portugal, he paid for the only for the ticket. He didn't pay the return ticket. He just went one way. That's it, man. His mind stayed somewhere in Naughty Land or whatever, fucking hell. So I hope you like it. I'm just gonna announce the thing I was about to announce. The sister brother podcast of this Encyclopedia Alcoholic, which history forgives but we don't, is going to do a 20 series episodes about the red lines, which is like when the Nazis escaped, you know, Europe to America, South America, to Brazil, to Canada. And they were really vicious guys that went through the cracks and did all sorts of absurdities, you know, directors of concentration camps, killers, you know, you wouldn't believe, man. I'm gonna explain there more about the stuff. I think I'm gonna record the first episode if my son is awoken, yeah. But you try to like it, man. Try to support us, two independent podcasts that, you know, just coming to the scene. I'm going to thank you. I'm going to thank on the History Forgives But We Don't. I'm going to thank all of you guys to listen to these two podcasts. People from Indonesia, from Hungary, from Germany, from the United States, from Britain, from Portugal. You know, thanks a lot, guys. You know, it means a lot that 6 months ago we started with, you know, which seemed like a little bit of a joke or a rambling. And now, at 6 months later, we got like 1,000 listenings from people around the world. So I have to thank you a lot. Maybe for the two podcasts, we have possibly you got like 115 listens altogether. But for an independent podcast that, you know, started really slow and started really low, and then we have to stop and then we have to restart and whatever, yeah. It was a kind of a trip for us. And we said like it was like a thing that we really want to thank you. And, you know, pass the pod, start, if you like it, man, tell it to your friends, or if you don't, you know, just don't tell anyone, don't speak shit about us. And, you know, it's thank you for everything with the support you've been giving us. So peace out, keep safe, don't let the bug get to you, you know. So, you know, see you in the next installment of Encyclopedia Alcoholics, which is going to be Bradley Newell, the frontman of Sublime, which he died of overdose. This one I know. This one is one of my favorite bands. So, man, keep safe. Do do your thing and just keep rocking. All right, see you, peace out.